the groundwork, you know, and from a very big picture standpoint, I'm going to show a little bit of our data, but I really want to just pose the questions and sort of lay the foundation for our symposia this morning. I'm going to talk about, you know, maybe why we should be important, looking at this thing from a big picture perspective. I like to do that. I like to remind myself why it is that I do what I do on a daily basis. And sometimes we get caught up in the hustle and bustle of everything in our jobs and with our families and that, and sometimes we forget the big picture. So I like to remind myself of that and do that first. And I want to also bring in this comparison with nitrous oxide and CO2. I personally have some biases there that we're not spending enough time in society focused on nitrous oxide, and maybe I wouldn't say too much on CO2, but certainly kind of think we ought to look at these things in simultaneous importance. And then, you know, can we reduce N2O? I mean, what's progress have we made? I'm not going to give a comprehensive review, but just mention a few things. And then, of course, we're going to hear so I'm the milk, and the rest of the speakers today are the meat. They're going to bring in the specifics on that very last question in particular. Okay, so do we truly care about people? Do we care about the environment? I'd like to think that I do. I think that's part of why I am where I am in my life. I remember as a younger man, as a teenager even, feeling like I didn't want to have anything to do with farming. I was done. I wanted to be anything but related to agriculture. And I found myself, though, as I started going through the university experience, I was going to be an electronics engineer, and then I was going to be a sports doctor, and, you know, whatever. And I just kept getting myself pulled. It's the only word I can use to describe it, back towards agriculture. And as I started taking those classes, I felt a passion about that. And I think many of us, as I talk with you, feel that same passion about the things that we do, about caring about people, taking care of the folks, as well as our environment. We're not always very smart. These good guys probably aren't really thinking about their actions. They've got it's innovative, I'll tell you that. It's exciting, and we get a laugh out of it. You know, they've got I'm not sure what that is, looks like floating something, and they've got their power strip there in the water, and of course they're drinking their beverages, and that might have some impact on their brain cells, why they're doing this. But, you know, we're not always very smart in the things that we do in society. We can look back at our forefathers, and they've made some mistakes that we kind of point our fingers at them, but the reality is we're probably all a little guilty of some kind of dumb things, both individually and as a society. And we really need to think about the impact that we have on the world. I think about this a lot. This is my grandson. I have one grandson, so I'm a grandpa now. But, you know, I think about what's my legacy going to be, and not just mine, but ours, legacy to society. You know, what are our children, our children's children, what are we leaving them? And that sounds kind of trite, but that's real. I mean, they you know, we don't want to hand them a world that's worse off than what we had, and we certainly would like to improve if at all possible. I think that's so critical. And, you know, we, especially those of us that live in the United States, have, you know, phenomenal blessings, more so than any time in history and the rest of the world. We're just, you know, we tend to get down on our things that are happening in our country, but the reality is we got a lot of great blessings, is the word I like to use, in terms of things that we have and the things that we can be appreciative of. But sometimes we take those things for granted, and sometimes we use them to excess. The world is rapidly rising in terms of population, and we kind of get a bird's eye view of history. You know, we can look at this curve that's pretty flat for most of the history of the earth, and then in recent years it has just taken off like crazy. The question is where do we go from here? You know, this is the estimated earth's population since about 1800, and then you know, these are actual measurements that have been made, and here we are today at about 2011, we're sitting there between 6 and 7 billion people. The UN estimates are, you know, worst case scenario, that trend continues. Most people think that we're probably not heading in that direction, but we're probably more on this mid-range path. But regardless, that's a lot of people. It's a lot of people to feed, and barring worldwide calamity that would drop that population back to where it was, we've got a lot of folks to take care of and have a reduced impact on the earth. You know, we think about, you know, most of what we do maybe is here in this country. Some of you work internationally. I've done a little international work. These are some of my friends from the Congo, and I love this picture. It's one of my favorite pictures. These kids are so poor, they don't have anything. But they don't know it. They really don't. They're just happy. Look at them. I mean, they're just having a great time, and I love them for that. But the reality is that things that we do have an impact on them and people in the around the earth. It's easy for us to talk about making putting a carbon tax or doing things that raise the prices of food, for example, I hear that. I say, you know, well, fine, we should do that because it's good for the environment. And it may be true, doing certain things are good for the environment, but anything we do that raises the price of fuel, food, or fiber impacts these folks. And the reality is that when the price of food goes up, the number of people who die from starvation goes up. Now, I'm saying that sometimes we need to make those policies. Sometimes we need to do things, but we just need to do so and realize there's a cost for the things we do, particularly when we start talking about carbon dioxide. Many of the things that are proposed have a potential large impact on the folks worldwide. Now, we may complain because we have to pay more for a gallon of milk, but when the price of tortillas goes up, people starve to death somewhere. And so I don't, whenever I talk about those things, I don't ever say lightly that we should do something that's going to have an impact on food prices. Now, I'm from a farm family, grew up in Idaho, agricultural family. You know, we like it when food prices are up. It impacts our bank account, but there always is that downside that we need to think about. And I want to frame that in terms of our discussion today. We've done a great job worldwide in terms of raising the yields in order to feed the growing population. We see these types of graphs all the time that we've had this tremendous boom in agriculture in recent years. Of course, we know that a lot of that has to do with nitrogen fertilization. Many of us were at listened to Dave Kissel last night talk about the history of this process. And he made some interesting comments that would say, you know, largely this agricultural boom has been a result of this fertilizer, but that hasn't been without cost. Nevertheless, fertilizer stands between us and starvation. It truly does. If we just said, okay, no more nitrogen fertilizer, the fact is that many people in the world would suffer tremendously. And so we've got to figure out a way to help continue to feed those folks and yet reduce the impacts on the environment. I just wanted to throw this up and kind of helps me realize, you know, this is, if we look at the tonnage of N, P, and K worldwide, we see that nitrogen, of course, is the biggest ticket item there. But as we compare the rest of the world's nitrogen use here, and this is the U.S., so, you know, that's important. You know, that's interesting to me. I mean, we have a pretty big piece of the pie here in the U.S., but this is a global issue, and fertilizer is being used all over the world. And sometimes I have the sense that, hey, you know, we're doing a better job. I mean, my family's using a lot less nitrogen fertilizer than they used to. They've cut it back. They used to be, you know, potato farmers, and, man, they just throw it on. It was 400 or 500 pounds an acre. It was not uncommon. And now we're down more like 250 to 350 pounds per acre, depending on conditions and whatnot. So, you know, we've made, you know, so I feel good about that. But what are we doing in the rest of the world? What are we doing in the Corn Belt? And what are we doing in China and India? And how are we doing in terms of efficiency? All right, so let's talk about this this climate problem. Let's spend a little time especially talking about, the doom and gloomers. You know, Calvin's here. I love this cartoon. Calvin's one of my favorites. You know, we got a lot of folks that are out preaching doom and gloom. We tend to have two sides, two extremes. We have folks that just, you know, the world is coming to an end. We have folks that completely dismiss it. And the reality is that there, to most things, is there's probably something in the middle. And unfortunately, those two extremes tend to discount. And a lot of folks just throw up their hands and say, I don't know, and so therefore I don't care. And I'm just going to go back and watch my TV show. That's the sad part about this is. So questions are we warming? Well, I think that, you know, we can factually say that, you know, we've been in a warming trend for a number of years. That's a fact. How fast are we warming is the real important question. The Earth, you know, it's gone through cycles of warming and cooling. That's, you know, we all understand that's a natural part of the Earth and the way it ebbs and flows. But if we are doing things that are causing acceleration of warming, and if that warming happens too rapidly, where plants can't adapt and we get into big problems. I mean, if the Earth's temperature truly is going to bump up 4 degrees Celsius in the next 3 or 4 decades, that's going to cause some serious problems, potentially catastrophic problems. You know, if it only goes up 1 or 2 degrees, you know, it's not going to be nearly as bad. You know, so where are we at? And I've tried to sit down and pin down people on that, folks who are supposed to know. And when at the end of the day, those who are intellectually honest say, you know, we really don't know. And we're not very good at predicting that. The models aren't necessarily good at predicting that. But we are in a warming trend, and the potential is there. It's something that's definitely of a concern to me. I would say the jury's still out on what the temperature is going to be in 2050. What percentage of the warming is anthropogenic? That can also be debated heavily. Can we do anything about it? And that's largely why we're here today. So we all know CO2 has doubled in the last 100 years, and a lot of that's been anthropogenic. I think we can agree on that. Warming potential from this source dominates the media, dominates what happens in the politics and scientific discussions. And that's a little frustrating to me, and part of why I was hoping to have this symposia and talk about it. Reducing anthropogenic CO2 emissions is difficult and controversial. Almost every proposed method of reducing anthropogenic emissions of CO2 has some serious downsides and expenses. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do those things. I think we certainly ought to be looking at, even if the whole global warming thing is a farce, the reality is we're using natural resources that are non-renewable. So we need to be searching for solutions. I mean, that's a given in my mind. And so in the debate of how warm it's going to be in 2050, I wouldn't say it's irrelevant, but there's, you know, it's a little bit irrelevant because we need to pursue these things regardless. But they all have a downside. It's not easy. And I would maintain that maybe with nitrous oxide, this is a much more potent greenhouse gas. It has a longer resonance time in the atmosphere, about 100, you know, depending on who you talk to, 120 to 150 years is its average resonance time. It also has higher absorptivity of radiation. And so it has a global warming potential, in CO2 equivalents, about 310 times greater than CO2. Now, there's a lot less anthropogenic N2O that goes out in comparison to CO2. But nevertheless, to me, that's an important thing that we ought to be looking at as society. When we factor those things in, it comes out to be about 10%. So therefore, you know, that may be justification for focusing on CO2. Well, CO2's, you know, 80-something percent, and nitrous oxide's only 10% of the problem, and therefore maybe we shouldn't be spending as much time on it. But I would maybe disagree. I think that some of the things that I'm going to suggest later in my talk are that this is kind of the lowest hanging fruit, the easiest stuff to take care of. I think we can reduce anthropogenic emissions of nitrous oxide with some of the things we do in agriculture in an easy way, with very little, if any, downside at all. We have the ability to make an impact in the very short term in a very major way without any downside, as I said. And we've all seen this. We've seen this anthropogenic emissions of nitrous oxide is large, especially in the last few decades. It follows similar curves as CO2. And most of that, as we know, is from agriculture. And this is rising. Assuming CO2 emissions decrease and the fact that fertilizer use in developing countries like China and India and other, you know, even more developing countries, continues to rise dramatically, it's entirely possible that that 10% number is going to get much higher as we, you know, as we lower, if we start lowering CO2 emissions. And but N2O is, in my opinion, is only going to go up because we're, we've got folks that are never used fertilizer in a big way starting to use fertilizer in a big way. So, you know, regardless, what if climate change is not a disaster that's predicted? You know, even if that's not the case, we really ought to be looking at fertilizer as a, is it's derived from non-renewable resources, just like CO2, and therefore we ought to be looking at ways to be more efficient. So, increasing end use efficiency should be a high priority for us in society, and part of that goal needs to be reduction of N2O. Emissions. I mean, that's just part of it, and that's part of what we're doing here today. I just want to say a few words about improving nutrient use efficiency. Our goal is to decrease the amount without having an impact on yields, because we still got to feed those folks. The fertilizer industry has spent a lot of time in recent years talking about the 4 R's of fertilizer use, and I applaud them for that effort. And I think it's a sincere effort. As I talk to most of these folks, like Paul Fixon, for example, I think they're genuinely interested in doing the right thing for the right reasons. But we talk about putting on the right rate of fertilizer, the right placement, the right timing, and the right source. And a lot of my research is that's what I've done in most of my career is looking at those things. And we've made a lot of progress in these areas. Whatever we do, though, it's got to, you know, I like to show this to my students when I'm teaching biology, is that whatever solutions that we seek, they have to not just be an environmental solution, but they also have to have an economic and a social component. For me to get my uncles to change the way they put on fertilizer, I can't just go to them and say it's good for the environment. Now they'll say, yeah, I want to help the environment, but I also have to pay my bills. And so it has to be a solution for them that does that. Plus, if it's more time consuming, you know, that they got to spend less time at home, they're less likely to do it. So we're looking for solutions that meet all three of these goals. I want to talk, and many of you know, I do a lot of research with polymer-coated urea, and I've talked about it in three sessions already in the last 2 days, and if you've been there, I apologize. I'm just going to mention just briefly some work that we've done, but I think that this is one potential solution. When we have, I work a lot with potatoes, and of course nitrogen is important for potato production. If we have deficient or excess N, we have a negative impact on yields. And we as potato farmers know that very well, that we have a narrow window and we try to fit that and do it well. But can we have, we've made a lot of progress in terms of rate and timing and placement, and we've really, in my opinion, kind of nailed that down very well. But can we further reduce that? We've done research on various polymer-coated ureas. Most of the work I've done is with ESN and Duration, even though we have worked with some other and starting to work with some more companies with theirs and with their products. But, of course, polymer-coated urea, that's a controlled-release fertilizer, it's designed to, you know, affect that timing thing and try to hit the window when that plant is going to need that nitrogen. Whoops, back up. So, you know, I'm not going to show you a bunch of data, but here's some yield response to for russet Burbank potato, and essentially here's my control. Here's urea applied pre-emergence, which is not what we normally do. This bar right here would be the urea that's split applied, and then here's my polymer-coated urea. And I just show you this, that both in terms of U.S. number one and marketable and sometimes total yields, we're fairly consistently getting better yields with polymer-coated urea. So why do I talk about that? Well, that's important for my farmer friends, is that we've got to be able to do this in a way that's economical for them. If you look at the economics here, and this is a compilation of quite a few years of data, we look at, you know, this is sort of that grower standard practice, and we sort of peek out, my crop value is right here compared to with polymer-coated urea. I get about a $500 per hectare or a $200 per acre benefit. So that's good. That's, you know, my family sees that and other farmers see that, and they're more enthused about adopting this technology. And they're happy about the environmental aspects of it as well. And so what are those environmental aspects? We could talk about leaching, but the biggest thing we've seen is nitrous oxide and ammonia emission decreases. One of the things we've done and we've looked at, and this is kind of just some traditional look at using gas chromatograph Looking at different days of the year and seeing that we're seeing some significant increases in how much nitrous oxide is being evolved from the soil when we use regular urea. This is two different locations. And then here's my polymer-coated urea and my control that are sitting down there. And, of course, it changed. This site had environmental conditions that were more conducive than this site. But, nevertheless, we consistently see that. One of the problems, though, with this technology of way of measuring is that we're really not getting good temporal resolution. So we started using this PAIRS, what we call PAIRS, which is a photoacoustic infrared spectroscopy. And we're getting readings frequently. We've set up experiments running every 11 minutes or 30 minutes or whatever we need. And we are able to get those gas readings on a much finer scale. So we're really excited about this technology and things. And we think this will give us better estimates of what is being lost to the atmosphere, which I think is important. Here's some data. Josh is going to show you this a little later, so I'm not going to spend time talking about the materials and methods and all that. But we're looking at both ammonia, and I know we're talking about nitrous oxide, but this is urea uncoated up here. And then here's my polymer-coated urea that's sitting right on top of the control. And here it is with nitrous oxide. This is a 45-day release product, and we've measured that, by the way, and greater than 97% of the fertilizers released by this time, by 45 days. And so we're confident that these are the results. We're not going to see some spike later on. But we feel like with this particular fertilizer, this is a duration 45-day product, that we're truly seeing those peaks and those differences. We've done some other studies that kind of verify that. We haven't just done one study. They seem to have similar curves. Bottom line is, and I'll let Josh talk about that more later, but we're saying that conservatively 38% is what we're estimating in terms of reduction in nitrous oxide, at least. Some studies more than that. It's going to depend on conditions. And also ammonia loss, and that's probably greater if we were to be truthful here. What this could mean is that we could have some tremendous savings in terms of the gases that are being going into the atmosphere, having impact on the environment, but also have an impact on the farm and be able to continue to grow good yields and yet have a decreased impact on the environment. So I'm regulating myself here. We've got time for 2 or 3 minutes for questions or comments. Yes. Yeah, so I'll just tell you, I'll field that question. We've done most of this work in the greenhouse. Most of what he's going to talk about is greenhouse work. We've had a struggle with it in the field, to be honest with you. Now, I know others have used it, but we get some data, and then it ends up getting the tubing gets full of water. So we had a big rainstorm, and everything was great until we had this big rainstorm, and then we've struggled a little bit with it. We're work in progress for field conditions, but that's the idea though. And we have a multiplexer, so we can take up to 24 readings, which is exciting about it as well. And so we can get really good, lots and lots of data points is what we like. And the other thing that's interesting about it is, I didn't mention this, is that we've measured consistently that the peak happens at about 5 p.m. Well, that's not usually when we take samples. It's the workday is done and it takes time to process those on the GC. And so we think that needs to impact what we're doing. And we ought to be taking those samples maybe when the peak hits us. Other questions? Yes? So the cost, it depends. And Alan's here from Agrium, and he could maybe answer that. But it's highly variable. In our experience, though, we're able to cover that cost. What I was showing you that net return, that was including the cost of the fertilizer that year. That particular year was about a 25% higher cost for the polymer-coated versus regular urea. And some years it's been more. It's going to depend, absolutely. Good question.